Welcome to this talk from the Canando Zen Meditation Center. Located in Mountain View, California, Canando's meditation practice is open to the public. For more information or to get in touch with us, you can visit our website at canando.org. That's K-A-N-N-O-N-D-O.org.
Good evening, everyone. Tonight's speaker will be Travis Marceau, and the title of his talk will be, I Think I'm Almost All Right. Welcome, Travis.
Thanks, Bonnie. Good night, everyone. So my focus on some of my previous talks was to cover some more socially focused something more of a rationale and more conventional in the way that we tend to think day to day. So I covered the values of democracy and value pluralism as a liberating force, liberalizing force. And so tonight I'd like to start moving more towards traditional Zen thinking because I find that in myself that entry into to today's world where people focus on social progress is a difficult place to talk about the self. So I'm happy to move tonight into those interests of mine. And I think, I benefited from those talks, and I'm happy to be hopefully talking more directly about myself and my own practice. I found this translation of the Heart Sutra that Thich Nhat Hanh had recently published. So I'll read a section of it for you now. This is, for those of you that are new to Zen, this is a central sutra in our tradition. Avalokiteshvara, while practicing deeply with the insight that brings us to the other shore, suddenly discovered that all the five skandhas are equally empty. And with this realization, he overcame all ill being. Listen, Shariputra, this body itself is emptiness, and emptiness itself is this body. This body is not other than emptiness, and emptiness is not other than this body. The same is true of feelings, perceptions, mental formations, and consciousness. And we've chanted this many times at Canando. But over time, I've been more interested in it. And how to apply it, of course. When I was asked to give a title a few days ago for this talk, I was listening to a talk of Suzuki Roshi's from 1969. And it was about this time of the year. It was late November or early December. And there was a pandemic going on at that time as well. And it was a short talk. But I'll just read a section of it for you. He says, I think it is almost funnier since I caught the Hong Kong Asian flu. Right now, in spite of hard work, I feel very good. So I think I am almost all right if I have a cup of water when I give you a lecture. I think I am quite all right. I think I am almost all right. This is the name of the talk. And in this talk, you know, he has everyone in the hall, you know, laughing, and everybody feels good. And I believe him. And, you know, I think that he says he's almost all right. So one of the things I really appreciate about those talks, and there are many of them online, and we recently had David Chadwick come on, and I think he has done quite a bit to preserve that and make it available to people. And one thing I appreciate, you know, when I get deeper into both Suzuki Roshi's talks, and I don't think he's unique in this regard, is he has a appreciation of Western culture as well. But he is grounded in traditional Eastern culture. And so I, being somewhat interested in history, kind of went back to the reasons why that is. So for those of you who are not familiar with more recent Japanese history, there was a very quick Westernization that happened in the late 19th century. And so Suzuki Roshi's generation was really one of the first generations that had access to Western-style universities, but they were still born and raised in that traditional Eastern culture. And there's an optimism to that. So he knew that Western culture was very excited about problem solving. And you know, in particular, this place, the Silicon Valley, is an extreme example. And rather than be critical, he was mild. It's very easy to say, oh, well, you know, we're creating more problems than we solve, or civilization's a mistake, or the internet is going to destroy human attention. But he just led by example, and he provided people the opportunity to practice. And Zen in America, in a large part, grew around him. One of the things that is still done in Japan is the monks will go out with a begging bowl. And I've thought about how that shifts, your attention out towards the world and letting it come into you. And that idea of returning to that of a beggar. And in Europe, that tradition died out at the end of the medieval ages. And we've had 400 plus years of modernity. Japan has had 150. And I've talked about this before, but I'm going to try to share my screen now. Does anyone know what this is? Well, this is the frontispiece of Thomas Hobbes' Leviathan, which was published in 1650. And the first thing I would like to highlight is all of the multitudes in the body of the monarch. So you can see the people facing the monarch. And if I zoom out a little bit, he has the sword. Oops. Okay. He has the sword in his right hand and the scepter in his left hand. And that represents the state and the church. And then if you go further down, this is a pretty influential book on political theory. I said I wouldn't talk about social stuff, but I'll get to why I'm showing this in a moment. He was a a political thinker, and he lived through the English Civil War. He was a teacher to royalty. You know, the English Civil War is one of those brief periods where monarchical rule was abrupted for about 10 years or so. The Commonwealth that was formed was run by someone who is widely considered to be despotic. It's one of the last books where you can read it, and it's actually you can hear the person behind it. It's very like, hey, we've got to figure this out, because one of the main messages of it was, if I'm paraphrasing, but it was, you know, people suck. People really suck, and they need a strong ruler to keep human misery from overwhelming society. It's pretty pessimistic in that way, but if you look at the frontispiece, I always try to look at it and think of what he's trying to say with that, and I try to think about collective visions, because we have our own conceptions of Sangha. And this is important to us. It's predicated upon serving each other, And I feel like the world we live in hasn't really moved in many ways beyond this Hobbesian vision. But raising children, taking care of the elderly, taking care of everyone, it's still going on. And the care, this caring of the culture, to the extent that we grow that, is my understanding of Sangha, and giving this is a good season to talk about giving. And, and how do we give? Well, we cannot give if we're overwhelmed with ideas of giving or thinking about the best way to give. It's just to give. So we can talk about literature. We can talk about art, Western thinking kind of being overwrought, overwhelming. But I think we're, you know, what we do with our practice is we join in service. And at some point, that's that way-seeking mind opens up that the point is just to practice and find our life, an appropriate life for ourselves. The body itself is emptiness. And emptiness itself is this body. This body is not other than emptiness, and emptiness is not other than this body. The same is true of feelings, perceptions, mental formations, and consciousness. So, to go beyond conceptual limits. So it's a great gift that we have it, and particularly here. I'm going to go back to some history. You know, in 1800, William William Wordsworth wrote this poem about limiting too much intellectual activity. It's called The Tables Turned. Up, up, my friend, and quit your books, or surely you'll grow double. Up, up, my friend, and clear your looks. Why all this toil and trouble? The sun above the mountain's head, a freshening luster mellow, through all the long green fields has spread his first sweet evening yellow. Books, 'tis a dull and endless strife. Come, hear the woodland linnet, how sweet his music on my life. There's more wisdom in it. And hark, how blithe the throstle sings. He too is no mean preacher. Come forth into the light of things. Let nature be your teacher. She has a world of ready wealth, our minds and hearts to bless, spontaneous wisdom breathed by health, true truth breathed by cheerfulness, One impulse from a vernal wood may teach you more of a man, of moral evil and of good, than all the sages can. Sweet is the lore which nature brings. Our meddling intellect misshapes the beauteous forms of things. We murder to dissect. Enough of science and of art. Close up those barren leaves. Come forth and bring with you a heart that watches and receives. I've enjoyed being outside in this time of isolation and more deliberate activity, working. And, you know, we have to plan, we have to read and think and do all those things too. But those activities have really flip-flopped in the last 200 years. You know, we're mostly literate now. We were mostly illiterate then. We're mostly working inside on computers instead of out being active. And that affects people. And it's a profound shift. It's that double shift of manual work, moving away from manual work, and then also spending all of our time inside. Or a great majority of our time inside. And now it's not just limited to text and books. You know, we have entertainment on demand. So I think that's the point I wanted to raise, is that, you know, not only do I believe Suzuki Roshi is almost all right, but that Zen is relevant in today's world, particularly relevant because of the nature of and the premium of having been able to grow this world around you, letting it present itself, clearing away the conceptual limits that we have. Even those formations and consciousness itself. It's almost all right. You know, in the Shakespeare's most famous book, Hamlet, which is, you know, it's in that 1600 range, about 400 years old. Most famous line, of course, is "to be or not to be, that is the question." And Camus, I enjoy reading Camus, but he's also very dramatic like this. And one of his quotes that I've read a few times is, I'll read it for you now. There is but one truly serious philosophical problem, and that is suicide. Judging whether life is or is not worth living amounts to answering the fundamental question of philosophy. All the rest, whether or not the world has three dimensions, whether the mind has 9 or 12 categories, comes afterwards. Those are games one must first answer. So it's a little, there's a lot of drama here, and but they're basically saying the same thing. And you know, there's no problem, and there's really, it's really not a question. It just is, you know. So I just, there's so many others, but I just threw those out, because we get bent out of shape with our minds, and you can look at the works of, in Palo Alto, they have the Rodin sculpture garden. You can go there and you can see modern people like all constricted and out of shape, and you know, just to sit upright as we did, you know, the other night for the Rohatsu was wonderful. When you're sitting upright, your head doesn't weigh so much, you know, it's like right over your spine, and you spend some time like that. I recommend it. But it's not, life's not a problem or a question. So, and I'm not trying to present a, you know, a grand vision of a better world. But just to encourage you to continue to explore your practice. And when you read the Heart Sutra, I think you'll find that, you know, it's possible to believe in nothing. So you can go about your practice and find an appropriate life for yourself. At least that's my understanding. Thank you.
We are now open for questions. Peter?
Thank you, Travis. Do you see any connections between the Leviathan and a Zen concept of Sangha?
The what was the first thing you said about the concept of Sangha?
Do you see any connections between the Zen concept of Sangha, our concept of Sangha, and the Leviathan?
Yes, I do. I think that the idea of a collective, of a large collective, is relatively new. And when we as Westerners think about Sangha, we have choices, and those choices inform what we do. And you know, prior to Suzuki Roshi coming to San Francisco, there was a Zen boom going on. People were reading books about Zen, and it was very thinky. And he gave people something to do. You know, that's fine. You can meet us here at 5:30 tomorrow. You know, that sort of thing. When he says, "I'm almost all right," you know, and everyone's laughing, that's a real collective, you know, and those people are showing up to practice with this man. But he's not imposing. He's not fearful or feared. And I wanted to bring up Leviathan because I think we need to acknowledge that for a lot of people and a lot of history, people were scared of groups of people. We're really fortunate to live in an open society. And that, you know, that Suzuki Roshi came along right when he did. So we can all, instead of looking up to some kind of figurehead, we can look out into the world together. So I can imagine a more complete Sangha that's comprising of an enlightened society where everyone is looking out to the world and seeing each other. Maybe that's an art piece that someone could make with more skill than me. Thank you.
Vanessa?
I wanted to comment on Hamlet. can I comment on Hamlet, Travis?
Sure.
Because it's like one of my favorite things to talk about.
Yeah.
The thinker and the heavy, I think, you know, that image of the heavy head is so great. Like the holding the heavy head.
Yeah.
And I think of Hamlet in that way, obviously, in this kind of, this character that's driven to distraction by overly thinking things and, you know, getting himself into a bit of a tiz-wars about, you know, what to do and what not to do and whether to exist or not to exist. And then I thought about just the other day, we were watching The Crown, the TV show, and one of the characters was quoting the end monologue, which for me, like every time I hear it, I come out in goosebumps. So can I just read it out?
Yeah, absolutely.
The answer to be or not to be, after he's gone off for a while and he's kind of found his, he's made a kind of, he returns at the end of the play and he's made a kind of peace with himself. And he says, not a whit, we defy augury. There's a special providence in the fall of a sparrow. If it be now, 'tis not to come. If it be not to come, it will be now. If it be not now, yet it will come. The readiness is all. Since no man of aught he leaves knows, what is it to leave betimes? Let be.
Yeah, I think there's an acceptance, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. I think I'm just thinking in the great state of Denmark and the war and the king and the wicked uncle and everything that's going on, you know, and it comes back to a fallen sparrow, you know, or I think of Wordsworth going out into nature in the middle of, you know, in the midst of the Industrial Revolution.
Thank you.
Brenda?
So thank you, Travis. That was wonderful. How do you know when a life is an appropriate life?
Well, I'm going to answer this a little indirectly, because when I came to Canando for the first time, I had oh, this is it, you know, this is it. This is an appropriate way to be. And, you know, in the years following, had a relationship to what, why that is, but the feeling of it, has not changed. So how do you know that your life is appropriate? Wherever we are, we have a choice of what to do in that moment. And in practicing actively in our lives, we pay attention to what's going on around us. And in paying attention to what's going around us, we're also paying attention to what's going on inside of us. But by observing what's going on around us with more clarity and attention and selflessness, which is a very Western world. It's like when we say, you know, universal self, we're talking about everyone. In the process of practicing and living and sort of making these adjustments, not throwing life out wholesale, but just making little adjustments over time, the feeling is that, you know, it's enough, that your life is already enough. And so that's what I take from it. And to the degree I've moved in that way, is encouraging, but it's a lifetime of work. And so that's why I share this like very small recording or quote from Suzuki Roshi. He's quite satisfied with things, and that's something to me, I think it's inspiring to me. It makes me want to practice well, so that I can be, you know, the person that that I know I can be and find my way. And we all have to find our way. And we can more easily find our way if we have help. So I'm fortunate to have a wonderful Sangha with you, Brenda. Thank you.
May? Thank you, Travis. For some reason, you mentioned that in Japan, some monk start to begging again, you know, the old tradition. I don't know, this just stick to my mind, that image.
Yeah, they never stopped. They continue to do this as a part of their practice.
I reminds me of Shikamaru Buddha, and then I think in his early years, people ask, why do you just go for work, right? And then do something and then feed yourself. Why you're asking food or something? And then I remember his reply is, I am planting the seed for people's heart. I'm like, whoa. I don't know, it's just that, you know, those beggars versus the seemingly abundance about this society, right? And we're living in this this universe, which is, we have a both, the two ends, extreme abundance or extreme starvation or something. It's just so extreme.
Yeah.
But this image of a beggar, I don't know, it's just so striking. And then so basically you're saying that's their basic practice in Japan right now?
No, it's part of their practice. And I've only heard secondhand accounts of this. It's a part of a ancient relationship that these cultures have with the monks, and that it's acceptable for them to come forth in this way in the world. And there's this line in the Genjo Koan that says, letting myriad things come forth and express themselves. So that's what I think with the begging bowl. You let myriad things come forth and express themselves. You know, if you're like this, it's much different than with the sword, right? But so much of the West, and yes, there was a begging tradition in the West. Modernity was the end of that. And so what can be recovered by us, I think, is the real heart of what begging means in a functional society that has compassion for every one of its members.
I almost feel like that's another way of, that's an invitation. Invitation or gift to the other side to give.
Yes. Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
And I had this conversation at work a few years ago, because this guy was curious about my practice, and I told him about the beggar's bowls, and he was, oh no, oh, that's unacceptable. That's not cool. And it takes some time. It takes some time for me to become acquainted with my own conditioning about being productive, maximizing utility, accumulating wealth and security, and what's it all for? You know, if you spend all of your time worrying about those things, you know, I think one of the things that always sticks in my mind is in those first few weeks, I was at Starbucks, and Les said to me, he's like, you know, the problem is that we just have to be so useful. Not that we shouldn't be useful, but we have to be so useful. Without that ability to pull back in a certain sort of narrow version of like a material utility, I think without having Zen practice, I don't know how I would have done that.
Well, I just have a wish. I wish inside I had the capacity to beg someday. Thank you.
Yes. Thank you, May.
Don?
Yeah. Just to clear something up, when you mentioned about possible to believe in nothing, did you mean believe in nothing, or did you mean have no beliefs?
No, I mean, believing in nothing. You know, of course I have beliefs, you know, and it's normal. But it's, you know, to go back to the Heart Sutra, the space that the emptiness provides, you know, it being a regenerative force. And so much of the West is about something. Just let's have more of something. And we can divide it up and like to categorize units, and we can call that science too. And I'm not discounting any of that. But merely the possibility that comes through emptiness.
All right. Yeah. Good. I mean, so it's emptiness you're talking about,
right? Yeah. Yeah. Well. Yeah. I. It's important for me to use words, I guess, and I'm trying to express, you know, something inside. I use a lot of different words, but like, you know, letting things come forth in a very like overwrought kind of space. It's like it can't, you know, it's just you're embedded with it, and, you know, that letting not only just, you know, the forms of what would be perfect, you know, the perfect life evaporate, but also my thoughts about like a perfect society or a perfect world. You know, that's where, you know, like conceptions, I think I said earlier, Don, you know, going beyond the conceptual limits is really what I'm referring to.
Right. So that's what you mean. Yeah. Because you get caught up in the concept of nothing. I find myself lately, the whole thing of nothing and something is just sort of dropping away.
And yeah. I like that. Yeah. Dropping away.
Cause you can get, without knowing it, I was having concepts of nothing. You know what
mm-hmm.
I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So.
And then you drop away and there you are again.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Yeah, good. Thank you. Good.
Yeah, thanks, Don.
It's very difficult, though, isn't it? Like, it's almost, you know, it's antithetical to everything, to so many values held in our society, in terms of, like you were talking about, being productive. You know, not doing anything is very much frowned upon. And being all right with things.
I think there's the desire to also get ahead. So there's a competitiveness in our culture that makes utility overemphasized, just like as a practical, like, you know, that's just the common sense of how, you know, you do things, you know, you do it, everything as efficiently as possible. But if you're not conscious of what that like overemphasis could do, you get to a point where you never have, you can't return back to, that big self, that big mind.
Yeah. And I was going to add to that, sorry, also just about the being all right with things, right?
Yeah.
Like I'm okay.
Yeah.
You don't hear that very often.
Yeah, you know, like just when people ask you how you're doing, Rhea was saying earlier, like, I try not to tell people I'm busy now. You know, I try to tell them I'm good and invite them in. To me, that's how I interpreted it. To you know, sit down, have a cup of tea or whatever, you know, I have time. How are you? And not getting caught by thoughts. and letting other people share. So, you know, in those previous talks, I was thinking about, you know, socially how open societies work, and we, you know, and then now I really want to talk more, you know, personally about how I practice and how it, and what it means to me, so that, you know, the Sangha, I feel a close kinship to you and to many members of the Sangha, in the sense that, you know, when we were sitting the other night, and, you know, it's the first time that we'd been sitting for like more than, you know, 40 minutes for a long time. And, you know, there's a very like noticeable shift that next day. And, you know, it's like a refamiliarizing of yourself to you. Yeah. And we're not perfectible. So that, you know, just keep working on it. We're almost there. It's endless. Let's do it again. Another half day sitting sounds good.
It's funny you should mention it, because I met with a group of like multi-denominational Buddhists earlier today. And everybody had this like post Rohatsu glow about them, you know, from every walk of Buddhism. It was just lovely to hear everybody's like experience of the weekend, and everybody, you know, did something a little bit differently, but there was something that we all kind of like quietly had in common.
It
was
yeah, nice. Yeah. It's a kind of ease, right?
Yeah.
But not in that sort of like comfortable, like let me get the like legs up on the lazy boy, where you're like, ah, you know, it's work to be upright, but there's some other kind of ease, you know, I notice when I sit for, you know, an extended period, and I missed that, and I've forgotten that I'd missed it.
Any other questions or comments? Well, thank you, Travis, for your talk tonight.
This talk was brought to you by the Canando Zen Meditation Center in Mountain View, California. For more information or to support this podcast, go to canando.org. That's K-A-N-N-O-N-D-O.org.